Hello and welcome to this week's Brewing Podcast. Well, it's certainly been a tricky period for equity investors. So this week we chat to Brewing Dolphins Head of Research, Guy Foster, about whether this correction is just, well, a correction, or indeed whether it's the start of something more sinister. We also take some time to talk about US midterms and, of course, offer the briefest of Brexit updates. But first, here are our disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewing Dolphins. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello everyone and welcome to the latest Brewing Podcast. I'm Ben Gutteridge, Head of Fund Research, and today we are joined by Guy Foster, our Head of Research. And I know what you're thinking. Yes, I love Guy. I can't get enough of him because he was only on 2 weeks ago. But what we're going to talk about is something completely different. We're going to be talking about what happened. We're giving a state of play, really, an update after what has been a really tricky month in markets in October. And then this week, of course, we've had the midterms. We want to get Guy's interpretation on what that has meant for markets, if anything. But then at the tail, actually, we may finally return to Brexit to see what Guy's take on the latest developments are. So let's start with October. As I said, a really tricky month for equities. Do you want to offer some sort of explanation why and how much it should worry us as investors?
Look, it's the second material period of volatility that we've had during 2018. And I think there are some common features of both of them, which actually kind of fit with what we talked about with clients towards the end of 2017. 2017, you recall, was an all-time low for market volatility. And so when making predictions for 2018, the safest one to make was probably that volatility was going to pick up. So we shamelessly made exactly that prediction. And the reason is because...
I'm so pleased it's come true.
Yeah, I know. Careful what you wish for, right? Yeah, yeah. But the reason that that we could say that with a lot of confidence was obviously because of how low volatility was, but the explanation for why it was that low, and the explanation, which I think is quite well understood, is that there was a lot of liquidity around as a result, not of the Federal Reserve's quantitative easing, but of the European Central Bank's and the Bank of Japan's quantitative easing programs. So what does that mean when we talk about liquidity? I mean, it's the amount of cash that's washing around in the market looking for a home. And in very practical terms, it means that if the market suffers a little wobble, which markets are prone to do, then there would be cash that was sort of itching to be invested. And so the wobbles would be quite small because the money that was available would enter the market and cap those wobbles off. As we have seen the Bank of Japan and the European Central Bank start to slow down their quantitative easing programs, ECB is expected to stop within the next couple of months, and also the Federal Reserve starting to unwind its quantitative easing program and raise interest rates, of course. These are all things that are sort of taking the liquidity away from markets, and therefore enabling volatility at the moment, I think, really to return to kind of levels which just do happen. You know, that over 30 or so years, you get plenty of these kind of little wobbles where the market moves on an issue of sentiment away from what we deem to be its fair value.
So we're sort of returning to a state of normalcy, if you like. This is a typical levels of volatility. And so you're not really suggesting that we're going to return to sort of a 2017 type environment where we sort of get a cruising gains in equities.
Yeah, no, I think that is difficult to imagine that we would have quite such a smooth tarmac to run on. Yeah.
Okay, so the question then is, well, I guess that is should offer some kind of relief, but what are the risks? Could this be the sort of start of a bear market? And what are the ingredients for a bear market that perhaps are missing?
Well, I think, the father of investing is this guy called Ben Graham, a Brit who worked in the US, and he has come up with all sorts of wisdom which really guides all successful investors ever since, or all of the most well-known, the Warren Buffetts and people like that. And one of the things he said was that in the short term, the market is a voting machine, in the long term, it's a weighing machine. Not perhaps the most easily understood language, but basically what he's saying is that the market will move around on sentiment in the short term, but in the long term it returns to the weight or the value or the sort of gravity of what a company is actually worth. And so that's why when you have a recession, the biggest drawdowns in markets have historically been associated with recessions, because those are the times when the market makes the biggest adjustment to its assessment of what the long-term profitability stream is from a particular company. In the meantime, you tend to have lots of little sort of wibbles and wobbles relating to the latest fears over a European debt crisis or an earthquake or something along those lines. And it's almost always the right thing to do to just fade those, to take note or to use them as an opportunity to invest more or to rebalance your portfolio, because they will invariably sort of bounce back, which is kind of what we are expecting to happen in this instance, principally because we don't believe we've got to the end of the business cycle, at which point there will be this kind of re-evaluation of how much companies can earn and whether their expectations of earnings are at a sort of cyclical peak or not.
Okay, well, we might come back to trade wars post the midterms conversation, but two points to sort of bring up about equity markets more recently, and then concerns going forward that this may be the start of a bear market. One is the bond market. We don't necessarily need to get too technical, but bond yields have been moving higher. That's interest rates at large moving higher, which devalues future cash flows today. So bond yields are on the rise and maybe are anticipated to move higher. You might want to have a comment on that. And therefore, equities have to suffer in that environment if bond yields are on the move.
Yes. So that's sort of straight out of the sort of corporate finance textbook or the investment analysis textbook. It's not, in practical terms, how the market does operate. The market, as far as you can observe, has not seen valuations expand in the way that you would expect them to when interest rates, for example, went from 5.75%, 5.75% down to basically zero. Now, obviously, the market was strong over that period, but if you had actually been valuing stocks on the basis that you can get nothing for cash and a 4.7% dividend yield from the stock market, and you were treating that dividend yield in the same way that you had done when you could get slightly less of a yield and 5.75% for cash, then following on from that, you would have seen a much, much stronger market. And if you look back to the early 1990s, interest rates have generally trended down. Valuations have not generally trended up. They've generally sort of trended sideways. And they're certainly not sort of at extreme levels at the moment. So it's not the case that stocks have discounted interest rates being as low as they are. There's still quite an impediment to people investing. And so there's plenty of headroom, we think, for interest rates to go up without meaning that you believe that stocks are fundamentally worth less. Now, coming back to the kind of weighing versus voting thing, if bond yields go up, as we have seen twice this year, when bond yields go up a lot, eventually there is some class of investor who is going to say, actually, you know, my natural habitat is bonds. I've just been pushed into the equity market because bond yields were so low I couldn't get the return I want. But actually 3% or whatever, 3.2% in the US, that is enough for me. So I actually will sell my equities and buy those bonds. And the market sells off on that news. But at the same time, the real value of those companies hasn't changed. So it's just a period of returning back to that fundamental valuation, which takes place over, you know, a few weeks.
So it sort of adds to the volatility angle that, you know, if investors see an alternative, because it used to be Tina, didn't it? There is no alternative. If there is an alternative, some of that money comes out of the equity market into the bond market, but doesn't destroy the operation of the operational success of the business they've left.
No, it doesn't change the earnings stream of the business that they've left. And to your previous question, the valuation of the company was never predicated on interest rates being 1% or 0.5% or anything like that. People have always required more of a what we call an equity risk premium to invest in stocks. That isn't really changing. So there will be investors coming in to buy those stocks and to get them back to the valuation that seems most appropriate. Earlier in the year, let's make no bones about it, there's obviously some very strong sectors which got to valuations which were a bit stretched. And that's the other thing that we've seen in this sell-off, is that there's been a real rotation in the US out of, obviously, particularly those tech names or the very growthy names, and into more kind of value stocks, the ones that had effectively been left behind for part of this year. And they're still really lagging the tech names, even after the adjustment that you've seen. But that's another factor which has created this kind of volatility.
Okay, and when it comes to recessions, I guess the investment community, economic community at large, are pretty hopeless at predicting them. And so sort of scouring the field, trying to understand what may trip us into a recession this time, assuming it'll be something unexpected, a large bulk of the investment community have sort of stumbled on US corporate leverage as being one of those concerns. I mean, are the imbalances there something that that worry you?
Look, it's definitely a factor. It won't be the thing that pushes you into a recession. It will be the thing that plays some role in determining how severe a recession is going to be. What pushes you into a recession is, first, you need to prime it. So you need a circumstance in which there is too much capacity in the economy. And then you need to ignite it, so you need a trigger for that. And then very often that's a pickup in the oil price, which is obviously something that we have seen earlier in the year, not so much right at the moment. But if the oil price rises very sharply, then people have to spend more on oil. They can't spend so much on fun things, yeah? And if there's excess capacity in those fun things, then suddenly the fun things providers actually need to start trimming some of that capacity, maybe rationalizing their workforce, to use the consultants' lingo, and that is what sets into motion a chain of events. Now, I mean, we haven't seen a huge amount of capacity expansion. We started to see it just at this late stage in the cycle within the last couple of years, and the oil price is not at kind of damagingly high levels at the moment, so it hasn't really impacted demand a great deal. But certainly those would be the kind of factors that would make us think, oh, actually, maybe this is closer to the end of the business cycle than we thought.
Okay, right, well, let's switch topics now and move to politics, and we'll start with the midterms. Things can change quite quickly in markets, but, you know, post the outcome, we do seem to have seen markets enjoy quite a rally. You know, do you think those things are related?
In a sense, in that I think we were coming back from that damaging October, and then we approached the midterms. The midterms are an event, and by an event, I mean it's that they're in a series of elections, and they take place on a particular day. Whenever there's something that is potentially market moving that takes place on a particular day, then the market action changes quite a lot, because, as you'll be aware, there are lots of traders and hedge funds and stuff like that who really trade these particular kind of events much more than fundamentals. So the prices of assets are set much more by those marginal buyers than what we pretentiously describe as the real investors, people like ourselves, who are much more interested in the weighing aspect of markets rather than the voting aspect of markets, which, you know, ironically is exactly what elections turn out to be. So how can we describe that in this instance? Because I think we talked about it before in relation to the Brexit referendum and, you know, the Scottish referendum and things like that. So what happened is the market was trending back upwards quite nicely. And then on Monday, people came into work and thought, right, midterms time. How can this unfold? Well, probably if the Republicans were to keep both houses of Congress, then maybe there'll be some tax bills or something like that, that, you know, some more stimulative activity next year, although I suspect there probably wouldn't be. But, you know, you don't need to worry about that as a trader, because you're only really thinking about the next day rather than the next 12 months. So that would have been the bull case. The bear case would have been, well, the Democrats might take both houses of Congress, and then they might try and reverse some of the policies that have been in place before, some of the supportive policies, the tax reform and so on and so forth. So that would be the bear case. Now, what happened was the exact case that everybody had anticipated, everyone expected, and that was to say the Democrats took the House of Representatives. The Republicans actually slightly expanded their majority in the Senate, which means that policy, that there won't be any more tax bills. Well, I don't think many more were expected anyway. And the president isn't going to be impeached, there won't be much point in impeaching the president or anything along those lines. So it's a stalemate, as it's been described quite frequently. So the market tried to have a sort of reaction to that. Maybe this means there'll be less spending, but it probably won't. So that's why the dollar initially went down and treasury yields went down. But ultimately, eventually, the macro tourists upped and left, because the midterms was a party that just wasn't really delivering. And so they went to go and trade something else. And the rest of the investment community carried on with where it had left off on Friday, which was starting to claw back some of the losses that had taken place in October.
Okay, and is there any, are we sort of clutching at straws here, trying to think about any sort of cross-party stuff that can get done? You sort of think about infrastructure, and you know, the headline suggests both want to get something done in this space, but clearly
everybody wants infrastructure. And remembering that members of Congress have constituencies, it's a bit like in the UK, so everyone wants infrastructure and everyone wants it in their congressional district. That's the problem with trying to get get infrastructure bills through the House, through Congress, is that, you know, the vested interests are built into that process, which is why it tends to be easier to agree on things like tax cuts than it is on, like, where do you build that bridge, where do you open that facility or something like that. So I mean, I'm not saying it can't happen, it could happen. You know, the president's likes infrastructure, he doesn't really care about the deficit. He'll attach some condition, perhaps to do with a wall or something along those lines, to it. But I mean, you know, something definitely could get done. Whether it will get done is too early to say, really.
But the punchline from the US elections are that this stalemate results in sort of a bit of a status quo, really no scope for radical policy change, and that's what, a healthy backdrop for this bull market?
No scope for radical legislative policy change, but obviously the implementation of policy, and particularly trade policy, or for example environmental policy, how you implement regulations, those things could change, but they're still in the gift of the president. So it's not, nothing's changed about.
Well,
about
I said we'd mentioned trade actually, so yeah, I guess now's a good point, is that, you know, the president's hands aren't really tied by Congress on this matter, are they?
No, not particularly. I mean, I don't think that it changes the trajectory of trade. There was obviously the story towards the end of last week that a breakthrough with the Chinese might be imminent. We're skeptical of that because the factors that the president, that the president's advisors, maybe not he himself, are concerned about with regarding Chinese activity are not going to be addressed by any deal that can be knocked up in a few weeks. They're going to be addressed by sort of serious strategic change on the part of the Chinese. So it's not easy to see how we would get to that that situation, certainly not in a short period of time.
So you've moved on from the midterms and looking at other things now. Obviously, but I mean, it's just there's nothing in the political construct that really sort of worries you about how it might impact.
Well, I mean, it is interesting, although I don't think it will be consequential in the end, that within hours of the midterm result, the president fired the attorney general and seems to have placed his role temporarily in the hands of somebody who has been openly hostile to the Robert Mueller investigation into the president's possible collusion with Russia during the 2016 campaign. So that could potentially have been a big sort of market factor that could shake confidence in some ways. It really follows this path of the president trying to recreate everything President Nixon did before he eventually had to leave office. But this particular night of the long knives doesn't quite follow from Nixon's almost comical one, where he kept firing investigators and their deputies kept insisting on still doing exactly the same thing until, you know, it had gone through several iterations. It was interesting, it was disconcerting, but I don't think it's going to be something that the market is overly focused on. Republicans had put pressure on him to suggest he must never do this terrible thing, and yet there doesn't seem to be that much of a furore from members of his own party and an insistence on tying his hands in the future.
Okay, right. We'll round out then with just a brief comment on Brexit. The headlines suggest that there is great progress being made on this on the deal, on a potential deal. How much progress do you think is being made, Guy?
Well, I mean, I think we're hopeful that a deal gets reached. We're not optimistic about how attractive that deal will be, but as investors, we're hopeful that that something reasonably market friendly can come out of this. But the government has perhaps helpfully, perhaps unhelpfully, quantified the amount of progress it's been making at various times. You know, sometimes the withdrawal agreement was 80% agreed, then it became 95% agreed, and more recently, it is the leaks suggest it is going to be reviewed by members of the cabinet, with a view to hopefully approving it soon. However, it is still 95% approved. So, in that sense, the progress is
complete.
95% complete. Yeah. So in that sense, the progress is sort of quantifiably zero over the last few weeks. We know what's in that last 5%. We know how difficult to resolve it is. We suspect there isn't a particularly appealing way of resolving it, and yet we still continue to think, with some confidence, that the alternative is so negative that agreement is likely to be where the government end up.
But given the challenges of that last 5%, married with the cheapness in sterling, because of those complications surrounding that final yard, you can't yet sort of, you're not yet sort of swinging the bat for sterling, even though it's looking cheap.
If I had to bet, I would say that sterling will be stronger into the year end than it is at the moment. But there's definitely a big tail risk around that. Obviously, if you invest in something like UK stocks, then you've got a way to benefit either way. You know, the UK will outperform other markets if the pound rallies, which would be our core expectation. But if it doesn't, then actually UK stocks, certainly some of them, quite a wide variety of them, will provide some protection in absolute terms against any kind of untoward devaluation.
Okay, great. Thanks very much, Guy. I really enjoyed that. I'd love to have you back on the podcast at some stage.
Well, we can probably arrange that. Have your people speak to my people, yes.
Okay, and to listeners, thanks very much for listening. Let us know what you think on Twitter, referencing hashtag Brewing Podcast, or leave a review on iTunes or SoundCloud or however you get the podcast. Let us know what you think. But until next time, many thanks for listening.